So, as I was saying, this chapter is called Reality Omnipresent. This is a French way of putting things, with the adjective following the noun. And I think it is something that is, of course, present with us from the very naming of this series, The Life Divine, which Sri Aurobindo had chosen for the title of his essays far before anything was considered for publication, long before he met the mother. So we can't ascribe this completely to the influence of Mira and Paul Richard in Pondicherry with him as he's writing here. But it is interesting and it is sweet. A very important chapter. Remember that when Sri Aurobindo came back to prepare these sequential essays for publication as a book, he made divisions and gave those divisions titles. The first book is called Omnipresent Reality and the Universe. So it's already in that sententious form, declaring that reality is all-inclusive. Nothing is excluded from it. It is everywhere, omnipresent, literally. And that this is within the context of the cosmos. So he is presenting a philosophy which begins from whatever is the secret commencement of the universe and following it out through all of its stadia. Each realm, each plane of business in the universe may be, in a sense, independent of all the others, and yet they are all embedded within a single reality, and all of them manifest here. So each stadium of those stadia is a reality placed within a larger reality, and all of it is compressed into what is being enacted on this material realm and on this globe. So the cosmic purpose is present. And in the view of Sri Aurobindo, who is scanning the secrets of the universe here, in the very opening of the book, and now we come to a chapter in which he can begin to unroll the grandeur of his vision. He has spoken to us about the nature of the human aspiration, that it cannot be stopped from looking for the highest solution, the broadest, most comprehensive possible, that will explain to us all of reality. What is transcendent, beyond space and time? What is intimately experienceable to our senses and our bodies as well? And what fails to explain either ends of that single reality causes that thesis to fail as a whole. He is looking for what integrates, for what brings into harmony the apparent dichotomies of reason. One side of the mind saying only matter and its world is genuine, the other saying only spirit, the eternal, is real. So he has looked in the second and third chapters at these kinds of negations, the canceling out that one camp has against the other, and he's said, our aim is to unite, is to go back to the core experience of those noble souls who brought this large vision into life in India That is where he wants to begin from. He calls that Aryan, which is speaking to a human aspiration, which is constant, which always pushes beyond, not at self-indulgence, but pushes beyond into self-conquest, which pushes beyond into the affirmation of life, not its denial, but a life that is lived fully from spirit. And so we begin with this fourth chapter, Reality Omnipresent, with a citation, a motto, as Sri Aurobindo calls it, from the Taittiriya Upanishad, one of the older Upanishads. If one knows him as Brahman, the non-being, he becomes merely the non-existent. If one knows that Brahman is, then is he known as the real in existence. So according to the nature and turn of the consciousness, one may arrive at an all-canceling non-existence and asat, that's the actual Sanskrit word, but one may also know that as what is as sat, and then existence becomes real. And now, as we go through this chapter, he'll look at what real and unreal mean as terms presented to the mind as interpretations of what is beyond mind. You'll see that this is the second citation from the Taittiriya Upanishad that we've met so far. The other was in the second chapter and led us into a depiction of that story about Bhrigu. So, now we commence with Sri Aurobindo's essay. Since then, we admit both the claim of the pure spirit to manifest in us its absolute freedom and the claim of universal matter to be the mold and condition of our manifestation, we have to find a truth that can entirely reconcile these antagonists and can give to both their due portion in life and their due justification in thought, immersing neither of its rights, denying in neither the sovereign truth from which even its errors, even the exclusiveness of its exaggerations, draw so constant a strength. The term immerse, by the way, in law means to fine, to deprive, to punish with an arbitrary penalty. So Sri Aurobindo is, again, looking for what will unite and reconcile, because we've seen that the claims of both in their own field are legitimate. Their exclusion, each of the other, is illegitimate. So we continue with him. For wherever there is an extreme statement that makes such a powerful appeal to the human mind, we may be sure that we are standing in the presence of no mere error, superstition, or hallucination, but of some sovereign fact disguised, which demands our fealty and will avenge itself if denied or excluded. Herein lies the difficulty of a satisfying solution and the source of that lack of finality which pursues all mere compromises between spirit and matter. A compromise is a bargain, a transaction of interests between two conflicting powers. It is not a true reconciliation. True reconciliation proceeds always by a mutual comprehension leading to some sort of intimate oneness. So we can never be satisfied if we're pushed into the finality of either camp. We feel suffocated, we feel limited, we must affirm every aspect and potentiality which exists within us. We cannot work with a philosophy that will, in a way, find a means by which we can accommodate the other view, but not give it full standing. Our position, simply put, is that the spirit is real. Matter also is real. And our view must arrive at a consciousness beyond the dichotomies of mind, which will unite those two. That intimate oneness that he speaks of here, in which one becomes the other, is indicative of a thought that he recorded somewhere in his notes, in which we're, well, many of us are familiar with. Ought to be something that we memorize. The opposite of a truth is not a falsehood, but another truth. We have to be able to see with the other eye as well. We need a vision which unites and not a vision which divides. Now, there is no question that in the flow of events, we have to have the tact, we have to have the sense to know what the divine will wishes to be done here and now. We must see sharply and exercise with finality and choose a side sometimes, because it is the truth of the moment that demands justification in our action. That does not mean that we deny the reality of the other position, even if we have to defeat it, you see. We could go to the Bhagavad Gita again for examples of how we arrive at unity in having to stare down the face of opposition and division. But unification is our goal. Let's continue with this paragraph. It is therefore through the utmost possible unification of spirit and matter that we shall best arrive at their reconciling truth, and so at some strongest foundation for a reconciling practice in the inner life of the individual and his outer existence. We are looking for a knowledge, but we are also looking for a way to live it out, to practice it. It is only by attaining that higher knowledge beyond the poles of division that we can affect a fully satisfying life for ourselves, and in a sense, justify the faith that the cosmos has placed in us, and being the dominant actors on the earthly scene at this moment. So, there's a sonority, in Sri Aurobindo's words, which calls us to be greater than the time-bound selves we might seem to be, and recognize the stature that we are called to assume. We are important in the proving out of the cosmic purpose. Omnipresent reality and the universe. We saw in the earlier chapters how Sri Aurobindo will link the growth of the human into the cosmic consciousness with the possibilities of arriving at this unification. So he picks up that theme here with this next paragraph and says, we have found already in the cosmic consciousness a meeting place where matter becomes real to spirit, spirit becomes real to matter. For in the cosmic consciousness, mind and life are intermediaries, and no longer as they seem in the ordinary egoistic mentality, agents of separation, fomenters of an artificial quarrel between the positive and negative principles of the same unknowable reality. The cosmic consciousness allows a view which unites that original urge to manifestation with the various worlds and planes of existence which come into being and stand in a linked chain, so that at the basis we have matter. At the heights we have spirit, but it is an unbroken continuum, really, because above matter is life, and above life is mind. They're both intermediaries. And when we are captured in our immediate experience with the impulse of life to affirm itself or to deny itself, as we've seen, that also is possible to it, or with the mind to enlarge its scope or to limit its scope, then we're lost and we don't get to the end of the puzzle. We have to get to this larger consciousness where all can be reconciled. He goes on to say that attaining to the cosmic consciousness, mind illuminated by a knowledge that perceives at once the truth of unity and the truth of multiplicity, and seizes on the formulae of their interaction, finds its own discords at once explained and reconciled by the divine harmony. So, the problems of life, if you remember from the first chapter, Sri Aurobindo has said, are essentially problems of harmony. It's when we're exploded out of the limited view into the cosmic and we can see more vastly that we can see the interrelationship between this oneness which maintains its unique state beyond manifestation as the one, but yet also this diversity which comes about from the manifestation from that one. They are not enmatized one to the other. Rather, the diversity expresses the oneness. And again, we go on, he's speaking about the mind having attained a cosmic status. Satisfied, it consents to become the agent of that supreme union between God and life, and towards which we tend. Matter reveals itself to the realizing thought and to the subtleized senses as the figure and body of spirit. Spirit in its self-formative extension. So spirit is intentionally encasing itself in this spatial expression, which is matter. This is something that our organs of knowledge, whether we're speaking of the senses subtleized or we're speaking about the ratiocinative mind, can come to appreciate. He goes on, spirit reveals itself through the same consenting agents as the soul, the truth, the essence of matter. The consenting agents, again, are mind and life. So, spirit ensouls itself in matter. And when we get to the dark mystery of what matter really is, this is what we find. That spirit above is that same thing here below. They are not two. Hidden in darkness, hidden in the concreteness of matter, is the wide, the illimitable spirit. Brahman, Atman. Both admit and confess each other as divine, real, and essentially one. Mind and life are disclosed in that illumination as at once figures and instruments of the supreme conscious being by which it extends and houses itself in material form, and in that form unveils itself to its multiple centers of consciousness. So this spirit is conscious being. It is sat, which is also chit. Sat, sheer existence, is also fully conscious. And this conscious being is innately powerful, has within it the shakti to act, and does in fact act. And in creating the manifestation, if you can say it that way, in manifesting the cosmos, marshals and distributes its energies through many planes, mind, life, and matter among them, those which are most near and familiar to our experience. And so, that conscious being can be revealed in any and all of these stationings of its consciousness. These are all planes and worlds within planes, but they are all centers of consciousness primarily. Everything is conscious. What we tap and think is unaware, is consciousness deeply involved in itself. It's how it became material. Let's go back to our paragraph and to the last sentence of it. Mind attains its self-fulfillment when it becomes a pure mirror of the truth of being, which expresses itself in the symbols of the universe. Life, when it consciously lends its energies to the perfect self-figuration of the divine in ever new forms and activities of the universal existence. So the transcendent expresses itself as the universe and as the illimitable numbers of beings and forces and positionings and conditions within that universe. So all individuals are contained in a universe which is itself, in a sense, not a spatial sense, but in another sense, contained within the transcendent. So mind is fulfilled when it can reflect that truth within itself, and when it can discern in all things that they are symbolic of that capital T, capital THAT. Again, this is a theme that we've seen already from Sri Aurobindo, that the mind is at its richest when it recognizes that everything in manifestation is a symbol of something transcendent, and not merely the name and form. It carries an inner significance. A symbol, as you know, must always have a significance and must be pregnant with that. And so that if you penetrate what is the meaning of the symbol, that thing comes alive to you. So the mind finds its self-fulfillment by recognizing and seeing and going, ah, there is a greater truth than mind, there is a greater consciousness than mind, but when the mind is capable of reflecting the truths of the eternal through the forms playing in time, then it is justified. It has fulfilled itself. Life is fulfilled when it gives its energies perfectly to the divine's potent expression of itself moving in space and time, ever refreshing itself, finding new forms again and again, smashing the old, embracing the new, filling it, sustaining it, smashing it again, going on to the next, because life must always be creating, must always be pushing and going farther. So, let's go to the next chapter. You might like to. Let's go to the next paragraph. In the light of this conception, we can perceive the possibility of a divine life for man in the world, which will at once justify science by disclosing a living sense and intelligible aim for the cosmic and the terrestrial evolution, and realize by the transfiguration of the human soul into the divine, the great ideal dream of all high religions. So, we have here a statement that the universe has a discernible purpose. It has a goal, it has a meaning. This is teleology. That within this cosmic purpose, there will also be an individual's destiny at stake. And of course, we'll see how he treats that in the very next chapter, the destiny of the individual. So the human soul, as he said it in this sentence, you see, is critical to the cosmic and terrestrial evolution. And that the greatest dreams of all these religions which have offered experiential roads by which we can meet and embrace the divine, that there is something grand which has motivated them, which has inspired them, and that it can be made real here on earth must be our faith, must be at the core of our action and of the communal spirit which we seek to embrace and concretize. But what then of that silent self, inactive, pure, self-existent, self-enjoying, which presented itself to us as the abiding justification of the ascetic? Here also, harmony and not irreconcilable opposition must be the illuminative truth. The silent and the active Brahman are not different, opposite, and irreconcilable entities, the one denying, the other affirming a cosmic illusion. They are one Brahman in two aspects, positive and negative, and each is necessary to the other. So Sri Aurobindo claims immediately, in regarding this self again, this Atman, that it is not merely a silent, intangible, aloof, immaculate existence, far from the movement of the universe. He has said that the silent and the active Brahman are indeed the same thing. They are one Brahman in two aspects. The positive, which Vedanta calls saguna, that is, having form, and the negative, which it calls nirguna, not having form, each is necessary to the other. And this goes back to the motto at the beginning of this chapter. If you choose to experience and see it as non-existence, into that non-reality you go. If you choose to see it as an existence, then into existence you go. The Upanishad has not said that only one is true and the other is false. It is said that the questing spirit, as it approaches that, has this choice, into which will you absorb yourself? Sri Aurobindo, in his own life and in the bent of his philosophy, is saying both. You must experience both. You must be the silent self and also active in the world. You must incorporate both possibilities into your enlarged being. It is out of this silence that the word which creates the worlds forever proceeds. For the word expresses that which is self-hidden in the silence. It is an eternal passivity which makes possible the perfect freedom and omnipotence of an eternal divine activity in innumerable cosmic systems. So, it is not simply the Indian conception which recognizes that the word, Shabda, the great assenting syllable, Om, is the beginning of the world, but also the Christian, the Kabbalistic in Judaism, all recognize and perceive in deep mystic experience that there is an utterance, a rhythmic intonation by the divine being which causes the worlds to come into play, to come into manifestation. But it comes out of that silence. Decades later, Sri Aurobindo writes in Savitri, In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. Silence is not inactivity. It is immobile in itself, but it can manifest. It can unroll its potentialities, and does, and it does so without losing its status in the silence. For the becomings of that activity derive their energies and their illimitable potency of variation and harmony from the impartial support of the immutable being, its consent to this infinite fecundity of its own dynamic nature. That last sentence reminds us that we are not alone or adrift here, that it is the divine that has become all of this. It is the divine that is at the core of ourselves, and that we may not see it right now. We may only read of it as a philosophy right now as we grow back towards that oneness which will allow that communion. But it is surely the foundation of things. It is the divine that has placed itself here in this universe and supports it. It is the divine that is all these inanimate things. It's the divine which is the engineering which guides and controls and directs the universe. All the collisions that occur are registered in the being of the divine. All destruction, all creation, re-destruction and recreation all occur within the divine. We must not see the world simply as a monstrous field in which God seems to have abandoned us, because the divine is not simply above the world, not simply transcendent to it, but has manifested this world and indwells it. It is inside. It is inside all of us. We have a few minutes more. Man, too, becomes perfect only when he has found within himself that absolute calm and passivity of the Brahman, and supports by it, with the same divine tolerance and the same divine bliss, a free and inexhaustible activity. We must become like the divine. We must have that same calm, that same bliss. Those who have thus possessed the calm, those who have thus possessed the calm within, can perceive always welling out from its silence the perennial supply of the energies that work in the universe. This is a deep experience, something that Sri Aurobindo had, especially with that second great realization which came to him when he was in the Alipur jail. From that silence, there is a movement constantly pouring itself out, working in the world. You can have that vision. And to have that vision is to erase confusion and doubt and replace it, not with faith, but with a knowledge based on your experience that the cosmos is being sustained moment by moment by this constant surge, this throb of the divine Shakti. If that lapsed for a moment, the worlds would fall into disorder if they existed at all. It is only because the universe is constantly being recreated, moment after moment, that we can progress. There's not simply one moment of creation, and it was in some distant past. Even now, even here, you can experience what it is for that divine as it begins to manifest the universe for the first time, because it is a constant truth. That bliss with which the universe is surcharged is available to the individual seeker. It is not, therefore, the truth of the silence to say that it is, in its nature, a rejection of the cosmic activity. The apparent incompatibility of the two states is an error of the limited mind, which, accustomed to trenchant oppositions of affirmation and denial and passing suddenly from one pole to the other, is unable to conceive of a comprehensive consciousness, vast and strong enough to include both in a simultaneous embrace. Mind is caught in the smallness of its division because it has difficulty seeing what is vast. It sees and prefers the minute. What it can dissect, it thinks it understands. But often it fails when it tries to move into the larger union. The silence does not reject the world. It sustains it. Or rather, it supports with an equal impartiality the activity and the withdrawal from the activity, and approves also the reconciliation by which the soul remains free and still, even while it lends itself to all action. Now, as we go through this chapter, you can see sentence after sentence which refers back to Sri Aurobindo's own grounding experience in 1908, the realization of Nirvana, of the Brahmic Nirvana. A year or so later, of the universal presence of the Vasudeva. And then, as he gets to Pondicherry, the climbing from one rung of the ladder of existence to the next in a way that is aiming at a complete unification and integration. So these words, which may seem to us to be philosophic, to be theoretical, to be expository, are instead descriptive. They simply are telling you what he experienced. And more to that, we're going to do one more paragraph. Yes, I started to say more of that next week, but we're going to do another paragraph. But still, there is the absolute withdrawal. There is the non-being. Out of the non-being, says the ancient scripture, being appeared. And there's a quote here, another citation. In the beginning, all this was the non-being. It was thence that being was born. And where we opened with the Taittiriya Upanishad, this is the very next verse. So now Sri Aurobindo wants to explain what this non-being means. Then into the non-being we must surely sink again. If the infinite indiscriminate existence permits all possibilities of discrimination and multiple realization, does not the non-being at least, as primal state and sole constant reality, negate and reject all possibility of a real universe? Well, his answer will be no. He is not denying that the soul can have this experience of non-being, of asat. And it may be that the Taittiriya Upanishad has this sense that sat comes from asat, that out of this blank denial of existence emerges the real existence. But Sri Aurobindo wants to trace this farther in our experience. What might it mean to us as we experience the metaphysical in a deep psychological way? The nihil of certain Buddhist schools would then be the true ascetic solution. The self, like the ego, would be only an ideative formation by an illusory phenomenal consciousness. Well, that's if the final state is a nihil. And Sri Aurobindo is correct to say that some Buddhistic schools might hold that position, but not all Buddhistic schools do. I think we won't go into a long depiction of what the generality of Buddhist philosophy aims at tonight. We'll have more comments to make about Buddhism next week. But let's go on, because we need to get to the next footnote as well, which means another paragraph. But again, we find that we are being misled by words, deceived by the trenchant oppositions of our limited mentality with its fond reliance on verbal distinctions, as if they perfectly represented ultimate truths and its rendering of our supramental experiences in the sense of those intolerant distinctions. So the tendency of the human mind in to describe to itself realities in one or the other mode is a limitation which our experiences at its highest, as we range into the supramental, will not permit. Non-being, he says, is only a word. When we examine the fact it represents, we can no longer be sure that absolute non-existence has any better chance than the infinite self of being more than an ideative formation of the mind. Because both are simply mental ways of expressing that which is beyond formulation. He goes on, we really mean by this nothing, something beyond the last term to which we can reduce our purest conception and our most abstract or subtle experience of actual being as we know or conceive it while in this universe. So it is something, remember beyond, the term transcend, It's on the other side of that transversal line, which separates the cosmic activity here from whatever that impartite, pure absoluteness is beyond. And that cannot be reflected really in terms of the cosmic truth. The cosmic truth may express some aspect of that Brahman, but it does not capture all of it. That remains unexpressed. And so, he will argue, can be considered non-being to the experience of the cosmos, which only has the experience of the affirmative side of Brahman. Sri Aurobindo, a paragraph or two ago, said, this Brahman can be negative, can be positive. It can be with form, can be without form. So, what does that without form mean? It is simply referent to what is beyond the range of our senses, what is beyond the ken, K-E-N, of our mind. Pardon me if I've read the sentence before. This nothing, then, is merely a something beyond positive conception. We erect a fiction of nothingness in order to overpass, by the method of total exclusion, all that we can know and consciously are. So we have constructed this idea of a non-being to separate it off from our experience of what we feel to be a limited cosmic movement, an unsatisfying universal existence, the ascetic urge to deny. Actually, he says, when we examine closely the nihil of certain philosophies, we begin to perceive that it is a zero which is all, or an indefinable infinite which appears to the mind a blank, because mind grasps only finite constructions, but is, in fact, the only true existence. So because we can't reach that mind, there's another Upanishad which could be cited. I mean, another verse in the Taittiriya Upanishad which could be cited here, which you may recall well, actually. The mind reaching for that falls back, unattaining. The mind cannot get that. It didn't say consciousness could not get that. But the polarity which is characteristic of the mind, the division, the limitation, which are signatures of the mind, render the mind incapable from grasping that directly. It can sense that through symbols, back to that, right? Or it can silence itself and merge the core of its consciousness with that. And in that way, mind can become one with it. So we have a third citation here. Another Upanishad rejects the birth of being out of non-being as an impossibility. Being, it says, can only be born from being. But if we take non-being in the sense not of an inexistent nihil, but of an X which exceeds our idea or experience of existence, a sense applicable to the absolute Brahman of the Advaita, as well as the void or zero of the Buddhists, the impossibility disappears. For that may very well be the source of being, whether by a conceptual or formative maya, or a manifestation or a creation out of itself. It's essentially the same thing. a formative maya? Well, in the old Vedic sense, maya is that which measures out, would be measuring out from itself. That would become this. When we say a manifestation or a creation out of itself, it's exactly so. So the nihil seems only a blank to the investigative mind, which wants to measure. Let me bring my measuring tape and see if I can measure out the universe. Oh, this is going to take a while. 3 feet at a time. How many eons will it take? The mind cannot define that, and so it calls it non-being. It calls it asat. It is just as true, Sri Aurobindo says, to call it sat. But when the mind experiences it as asat, this is what it's driving at. So, there I think I'll leave it for this evening. And next week we will begin with the sentence, and when we say that out of non-being, being appeared, we perceive that we are speaking in terms of time about that which is beyond time. That is a categorical error. So we'll finish this chapter, Omnipresent Reality, next time. A most important chapter. Sri Aurobindo is again going to base his entire investigation of the universe and what we may do to affirmatively fulfill it upon this real being. We will not accept the idea of a vacancy as being that which manifests the world. No. It is a reality. It is a divine investiture which has a secret purpose which unrolls itself evolutionarily through time, and in which the individual soul has a key role to play in uniting all of this. Our very souls, the very center of our being, is the very site, S-I-T-E, at which this unification must occur. So, anyway, questions? Comments?
Good stuff. The question I have that I put to me, if everything is an expression of the divine, if the divine is manifested in each single atom and light of creation, then should we accept the world as it is, or is the manifestation of the divine, there's no struggle, there's, you don't need to change anything, you don't need to fight any fights.
Mm-hmm. Sri Aurobindo's first chapter answers that question, the human aspiration, in which he says the human cannot accept stasis, cannot remain in one place, is restlessly moving forward, cannot be satisfied with either answer, which seems to exclude the other. So to be still, to simply accept the world as it would be to the human spirit a defeatist position, impossible to reconcile itself with. Must always be on the go, looking for another peak to climb, another depth to sound, and some experience which would reconcile the two and make them each part of the other. So we can try to quit for a while. We can take an inning off. but we'll always be drawn back to it. And as a matter of fact, it may not be in the Life Divine that Sri Aurobindo has said this, but and that the mother has intoned the same truth, that many are the souls who took the sannyasi's path to leave the world, but having got that moksha, then discover that they feel compelled to come back to the world and re-enter it in order to improve it, to carry it, to push it, to nudge it, to urge it towards divinity. And so too, there is a freedom. There is no compulsion other than the truth that is within us to make us move forward. So those who don't want to aspire won't. Those who don't wish to evolve won't. Yes, there is a perfect freedom given to the soul as it enters the manifestation for what it wishes to do. But in closing itself off to certain categories and ranges of experience, it denies itself a greater bliss. Sri Aurobindo, without even having to say it, is taking that Aryan standpoint, which sees constant growth as leading to greater and greater experience of beatitude, that we have more bliss, that we achieve greater knowledge, that more power is vested in us responsibly, so that we can conduct and use it well and affect something for that as an offering for all the wonders that have been given to us here, so we can move and live gratefully in the world and grow if we choose to. If we want to remain shut up and small, we can do that. And maybe that's a good round of existence for a while. But here's the thing. Even if somebody is satisfied with that existence, and it's a small existence, if they're next to a larger one, if one day the little puddle finds itself next to a lake, it may say, gee, that lake looks inviting. Maybe I'll leave my pond. Maybe I'll leave my puddle. Maybe I'll leave my stream for this lake. Maybe that lake becomes an ocean. Maybe that ocean becomes immeasurable. And maybe that's where we're going. Sufficient substance for meditation tonight, isn't it? So we'll go and sit for our meditation. Namaste. Jai Ma.